طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The mission of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is John Roberts. This week we feature Israeli human rights attorney Michael Sfard, who uses his legal talents to challenge the occupation by representing Palestinian resistors in the Israeli courts. Here we get insight into the Israeli justice system, which, yes, I know, is an oxymoron. First, the introduction, and then the presentation of Michael Sfard, speaking at the NYU Law School.
Mr. Sfard earned his law degree from Hebrew University and was admitted to the Israeli bar in 1999. He later earned his master's in international law from the University College of London and has been practicing in Israel-Palestine ever since. In 2005, along with a group of friends and volunteer lawyers, Sfard put together Yesh Din, a legal organization that's done a marvelous job documenting the epidemic of impunity that pervades through the many layers of Israel's occupation and the tapestry of the settlements. Michael also works as a legal advisor to Breaking the Silence, an organization of Israeli soldiers who got started by documenting and sharing their own confessions to what really happens in the occupied territories, hoping to find an audience within Israeli society. Michael's also worked as legal counsel for Peace Now, the Human Rights Defenders Fund, and other humanitarian aid and relief organizations.
I want to start with an event that happened to me a bit more than 10 years ago, which I think could illustrate some of the dilemmas that I've been breaking my head with over the last almost two decades of work in Israel-Palestine. It was the summer of 12 years. These were the high days of the construction of the separation fence, separation wall. I'm sure you all know what the separation fence is, but in two words, the great project that Israel has embarked on to build a barrier that would cut the territory between the Jordan River and the sea, not along the green line, but along the lines that it chose. And that route of the fence that was chosen by the government of Israel at that time was about to eat more than 16% of the West Bank and leave it on the Israeli side of the fence, grabbing cultivated land that belongs to more than 100 Palestinian villages. Many human rights lawyers back then were engaging in litigation, challenging the different segments of the wall, and I was invited by two village heads of village councils in the center of the West Bank for a meeting to see if I thought there is any way to challenge the specific segment that damaged their livelihood. The two villages were Azun and Nabi Elias, very close to Qalqilya city. When I got there, we met in a gas station in the middle of what I could say nowhere, overlooking the already built fence that took thousands of dunams of their lands. Looking at the scene, it was clear to me that there is something really wrong with the way it was constructed. The nearby settlement, which the fence was supposed to protect, was very far away from the location of the route of the fence. Actually, it was something like more than two miles aerial distance from the build-up area of the settlement. So we were sitting there in this gas station, and I was talking to these two gentlemen. who were clearly very much concerned about the fact that their communities have lost significant amount of their annual livelihood. I was younger then, and very, well, I thought there was a lot that could be done about this case, and I told them, look, the Israeli government has told the court time and again that the distance they need from build-up areas is something like 400 meters, and I can see here that the distance is much larger, and actually more than almost 2,000 dunams of your very densely cultivated olive groves have been taken away. So I think we have a good case. I think we can go to court and challenge that route and ask that the fence would be dismantled and be built closer to the settlement. And they looked at each other and looked at me and asked me, can you ask for them to install a gate in the fence? I thought I didn't hear well, so I said, look. And I was extremely... you know, I was really appalled by that question. I said, I think we can actually win this case. I think we can challenge the route and ask for the fence to be completely dismantled. So they asked, well, how long would a case like that take? And I said, well, it can take 2, 3, maybe 4 years. They said, you know what? We want a gate. If we'll have a gate, we can cross during the harvest season and get our olives and make oil. Now, driving back to my office in Tel Aviv, I was, you know, inundated with questions. I knew that the chance of me getting them a gate was good. It might even be that I would not have to go to court for that. In fact, this is exactly the role that the army is entrusting with or wants to impose on me, on us, human rights lawyers or human rights activists. They do not know how to manage the wall that they have built. They did not know, they didn't take a second to think where should they install gates, how long it will take for a farmer to get to his or her land if a fence cuts between their home and their lands. They need us to supply them with this data. It will become a joint venture. This wall that I thought was a vicious atrocity, that was illegal and immoral in every centimeter, square centimeter that it took, was something that should I be involved in making it better, more manageable, but lessening the suffering of my clients. I will put this dilemma on a freeze for a moment, and I'll go a little bit back in time. So what does a nice Jewish boy, and I am a nice Jewish boy, who was destined, like any nice Jewish boy, to be a private eye doctor or a money-making lawyer, what happened that he has deteriorated so much to become a human rights lawyer? Well, unlike what many people think about Jewish parents, many Jewish parents want their kids to be people who change the world, who work for a better world. My family came to Israel from Poland was deported from Poland. My father was in prison in the 60s for his pro-democracy activity. My maternal grandfather was fired from the Warsaw University where he served as a professor because of his pro-democracy activity. And both my set of grandparents were Holocaust survivors. In this atmosphere that I grew up, it was clear that there is some weight to our collective history, our collective biography, as members of a of a people that was persecuted, that was the victim of a genocide, that was discriminated against for centuries. And so, when I thought of what I want to do, I thought of Tikkun Olam, and I also was very much influenced by the American court drama series L.A. Law. And so, when I thought what I want to be when I grow up, I thought I'll be a lawyer that does good. And it's very simple. You can... What do you want to do in life as a human rights lawyer? You want to represent and support and help and provide redress to those who are weakened, to those who are victims of abuse, to those who are oppressed, and you want to fight the bad guys. It's so simple. I never thought, and you don't learn that in law school, even in human rights courses, that it's not that simple. That to do good, or even less than that, to do no harm, is a mighty task. And sometimes you can be with all the best intentions and eventually find yourself, as I have, taking tourists, friends, colleagues that come from abroad, or diplomats or journalists on a tour of the separation fence, and having many of the segments being changed because of my litigation. And I found myself saying, I'm one of the architects of this wall. I did not want this wall. I believe that this wall is illegal, of course immoral. I believe that the permit system that is attached to the fences, which makes a distinction according to nationality, and declares that the whole area between the fence and the green line inside the West Bank is a closed military zone for Palestinians, but it is not for Israelis and tourists with a visa to Israel, a group that is growing smaller and smaller. That this is the epitome of the crime of apartheid. So, how to square this dilemma? And of course, the example that I gave is by no means a one-off event. I'll give you another example, which is much more up-to-date. On February 6th this year, a few weeks ago, the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, has ordered the Israeli civil administration and Israeli army in the West Bank to commit a war crime. It was the evening of February 6th, and the Knesset has voted in second and third reading on a bill, which became a law, that would expropriate, confiscate private Palestinian lands across the West Bank for the exclusive use of settlers. The bill called, or the law that is named the regularization law, just think of the semiotics of it, we're regularizing what is completely abnormation. This law provided that if Israelis have built illegally through trespassing into Palestinian private lands, then under certain conditions, but very lax ones, these lands that they built on would be confiscated, and the Israeli authorities in the West and the Israeli governmental authorities in the West Bank would have to allocate them for the use of those who already dwell in them, meaning the Israeli settlers. Not every Israeli settler, not every Israeli, just those, just the outlaws, just those who trespassed into them. I'm not allowed to get any land from these expropriated lands. Only those who have committed a crime. Now, this law also states that lands that were grabbed by settlers who planted on them and are cultivating them would also be expropriated. Peace Now, the oldest and biggest Israeli peace group, who runs the most important settlement watch program for many years now, has researched this law and got to the conclusion that about 11,000 dunams of privately owned lands would be expropriated under the first category of lands on which Israelis have built illegally, and another around 25 to 35,000 dunams of cultivated lands that were agricultural lands that were grabbed by settlers would also be expropriated. That means thousands of families, tens of thousands of landowners that would lose their lands, lose the title over their lands, not just the use. They already lost the use over their lands, but at least they can hope for redress from the courts now. And this law was a backlash to all those high court cases, many of them I was involved in which the court has ordered to dismantle and evacuate illegal outposts, illegal settlements were built without governmental official permission, but with a lot of governmental aid. Now, a big debate sprung out in the Israeli left, or what is left of the Israeli left. Should we go to court? Should we challenge that law in the Israeli High Court of Justice? The premises of this debate was there's a good chance, that's what people, most people assumed, there's a good chance that the High Court would abolish the law, declare it unconstitutional, maybe even declare that the Israeli parliament has made an ultra-virus, meaning an act that it does not have the authority to do, meaning legislation outside the borders of Israel that applies to non-Israelis. And I agree that there is a good chance that the bill will be that the law would be declared unconstitutional by the court. Even the current attorney general, who is the by far the most right-wing attorney general we ever had, Avichai Mendelblit, has declared that he will not defend the government if a case would come before a challenge would come before the court. Now, why was there a big debate on whether to challenge that law or not? The reason was that this law has achieved a unified condemnation in the international arena, and it also raised the chances of intervention by the International Criminal Court in such a direct and official violation of not one, not two, but three prohibitions of international criminal law, and with the ICC, International Criminal Court's prosecutor, engaging for 2 or 3 years now in an inquiry of whether to launch criminal investigations against Israel or Palestine for different practices they both engaged in the framework of the conflict. This law was seen as probably one of the best, one of the most forceful, powerful forces to push the prosecutor into launching a criminal prosecution. So many column writers, activists, politicians from the left has called on the Israeli human rights organizations not to challenge the regularization law and not to save Netanyahu from this awful fate of the international community raiding on Israel to end the occupation and the criminal court arresting Israeli officers and Israeli politicians. I'm being cynical. So how do we go about with this dilemma? What is this dilemma made of? Well, first and foremost, this dilemma is quite, it's not unique to fighting or litigating in the abuser's court, but definitely in the, not just the abuser's court, but in the abuser's system, because the abuser many times provides different channels of redress. Courts is one of them. So using the channels that is provided, that is offered by the abuser, is something that that is not unique for a mass abusing regime like the Israeli occupation. It can happen in a more normal liberal democracy. But it seems to me that in a theater of a mass abusing regime, the question is much more acute. And why is it so acute? Well, there are probably, we have to appreciate that for a human rights activist, and the human rights lawyer is a human rights legal activist. He or she are activists. For the human rights activist, there could be three planes of purposes, three purpose planes for action. And the first and the simple one, and the only one that I envisaged when I went to law school, was securing or pursuing a remedy for the abused individual. That's what human rights is all about, isn't it? A client comes to my office, says, my wife is abroad and they won't let her in, and I want to unify, I want a family unification. Can you do that for me? If I think that I have the tools to bring about entry visa for this person's wife, that's his whole world. If a client comes to me and says, look, they're going to uproot my olive tree. This is 100% of my livelihood. That's what I do. It's not just my livelihood. This is my culture. This is who I am. This is my identity. I'm a farmer. Can you do something for me? You know, if I think there are 10% of chance that I could save his grove as a human rights activist, this is what I should do. I shouldn't ask any other questions. Well, a human rights activist has other planes of purposes for his or her advocacy and activity. The second one is to secure or to pursue a policy change. Not all abuses are one-off. Actually, many of them are part of policies. And many times, the biggest, the most sought-for result that human rights activists want to achieve is a policy change or a policy abolition. If there is a policy of house demolitions, punitive house demolitions, let's assume there is a country that allows itself to punish the families of people who are suspected, not even tried, but suspected of violent offenses. That's a policy. And the human rights lawyer has at least two tasks. One is to prevent the demolition of the house of the family that he or she represents. But there is another task, some would say more noble task, to end the policy, to secure a judgment or a decision, a political decision, or a public outcry that this policy will end. And that way we can secure protection for all families. But in a massive human rights abusing regime, you have a third plane and of purpose. And that third plane is unique to those either non-democratic regime or what I call mixed theaters. Mixed theaters are the courts or institutions of a regime that has democratic traits. You know, it has an elected legislator. It has a loyalty to basic human rights values. It has separation of powers and the rule of law. But, for example, its courts oversee a non-democratic regime that this government or this country runs. So democracies who engage in occupation is a good example of a mixed theater. A mixed theater can also be a government or a court that adjudicates an issue that has to do with an external conflict. When a court, a domestic court, is asked to adjudicate a case between the government, that is a sister branch of government, and, let's say, an enemy civilian or an enemy combatant, then the neutrality or the facade of neutrality that courts are supposed to have when there is a case between a citizen and his government or her government is no longer there. And not only that this foreign national is not involved in has no voice and political weight in the country where he is being tried at, but also he's the enemy of that country. So in that case, I term this as a mixed theater. So in mixed theaters, you might have, and especially in the first type, the one. A democracy that has a non-democratic regime that is being handled by it, you have another plane of purpose for the human rights actor. And that purpose plane is not only a policy change, but a regime change. And it's not a very... I would say not all human rights activists would agree. The Israeli Association for Civil Rights has in the past, until the 90s, had a firm view that the fact that there is an occupation is not a human rights issue. The occupation is a source of human rights abuse which must be dealt with and must be resisted to, but the occupation in and of itself is not a human rights abuse. It is allowed by law. Occupation is a situation that international law does not prohibit. Actually, it allows, it acknowledges, and it regulates. Well, since then, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel has changed its position. And I don't think there is any human rights NGO today in Israel that does not would not subscribe to the position that ending the occupation is one of the ambitions of the human rights community. So we have three levels of goals, of objectives. Redress for the individual, policy change, and regime change. And these can sometimes conflict. And that's what happened to me when I went to Azun. And that's the question that was presented to us, the human rights community in Israel, by left-wing leaders and column writers when it came to the regularization law. Now, it's really difficult to square this. At the end of the day, there aren't many benchmarks. I haven't seen any textbooks, which provide an answer to the quandary. However, we can think of this dilemma in the following way. The human rights, the morality of human rights, the ethics of human rights dictates to pursue the well-being of the individual. And when I faced the question of whether to ask for a gate, when I was faced with the question of whether to file a petition against the confiscation law, my answer was, and by all means, in the Q&A, please prove me wrong, my answer was, I cannot sacrifice the individual for some greater good. Because if I do that, then I lose the most fundamental basis for human rights action. And doing that, the arithmetics of what would happen if I sacrifice the individual, what kind of chain of events would bring about the end of the occupation or a policy change, is something that a human rights activist should never be engaged in. That was my personal decision. To say that if you wake me up late at night, I would always be certain of that? No. But this is the one and only, the one decision that I made back then in 2006, that I'm here to help individuals. I will insert the considerations of the second and third plane only when they do not collide with the primary, the primacy of fighting for remedy to the individual. So back to the Azun gate. I did ask for a gate, but I have also managed to convince my clients that in parallel we'll also file a petition to remove the whole segment of the fence. It has made the case weaker, because it's one thing if you have a community that cannot get to their lands, and it's another thing if they have a gate. The good thing was that the reality was that the army wanted to place a gate, but they were so slow that by the time we got to the first hearing, there was no gate yet. But they have declared that they will install a gate. And what happened was something that, you know, you go to court, you never know what will happen. And what we did not know and did not foresee that will happen was that we found out that one of the biggest lies about the separation fence took place in the case of that specific segment. A friend of mine and me went to the nearby settlement because we wanted to understand what was the reason the architects of the wall have rooted it so far away from the build-up area. It was not regular. It was not the way they did it in other places. So my friend, that is less known in Israel than me, went into the settlement, said that he's thinking of investing in that settlement, but he wants to know what are the prospects and what are the plans for the future. And they were very happy, and they showed him the plan to build an industrial zone exactly on the lands of my clients. And when we showed that to the court was furious, not only that the route was planned not according to living people, but according to future expansions, but also that in a previous case, the main person who was in charge of the authority that was planning the wall lied to court and said that that this segment was designed according to security needs. So he was sacked later on because of that case. So you never know how what a case will bring about. That segment was we won that case. That segment was removed, and my clients today can get to their land without crossing any gate. As for the regularization law, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, Yesh Din and Peace Now, have filed last week a petition. I'm one of the acting lawyers for those groups, and I maybe have to say that probably this whole affair of Jewish Israelis, white Jewish Israelis that are thinking between themselves whether to file a petition or not, is should all be seen in the right perspective, because eventually the people who should decide whether to go to court or not are not us but the Palestinians, and they by their thousands asked us to go to court because they understood that their best chance of securing their title is through the domestic court and not through some kind of a fantasy that the ICC will save them, or the international community that will come with, planes and whatever. So 25 local authorities from across the West Bank are the petitioners in that case, and hopefully the law would be abolished, would be vacated, and the people will retain the title for their lands. Now, along the years since 2006, the atmosphere in which human rights activists in Israel work has changed dramatically. It became violent, it became toxic, it became insightful. And I'm sure you all know that, but Israel is going through a massive change. It is going through a change that I can pinpoint to the exact cornerstones of that process. But basically, if we'll take the Kast-led operation of 2008-09, this was, I think, the most dramatic event that has later on made some people in the leadership of the Israeli right understand that Israeli human rights sector has much more power than it seems that it does. And after after Kast-led, some 10 Israeli NGOs have published reports. Of course, also Palestinian NGOs published their own reports, but the Israeli ones who were handed to the Goldstone Commission that was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council was something that was seen in Israel as an act of betrayal. For the first time ever, Israeli politicians have began talking about Israeli groups who are speaking outside the country as traitors, as something that has to be tackled with. And two main organizations that were created in two right-wing think tanks were launched to crack down on the two main sources of funding of Israeli human rights NGOs. NGO Monitor, who was created in order to storm the what is called foreign governmental funding. And foreign governmental, by the way, is not just money that comes directly from governments. It can also be, and in many cases it is, donations that governments provide to independent funds like Oxfam or the Norwegian Refugee Council or others. And these independent funds decide independently of the governments who to fund, to whom to donate. And so NGO Monitor began that, and another very nationalistic Israeli group called Im Tirtzu incited against the New Israel Fund, which is the main other source of funding for Israeli human rights organizations, not only, but also for Israeli human rights organizations, and that is basically donations from American Jewry. So these two together have basically targeted the two only, almost only, sources of income for Israeli human rights organizations. The tone of incitement against those organizations have become more and more radical, more and more extreme as the years went by. And today we are facing a completely different reality and a completely different environment of work than we had some 10 years ago. If someone would have told me 10 years ago that my office would be followed by a private investigator for 3 years who was paid by right-wing organizations, someone would have told me that a person who would be indicted for calling for my assassination. If someone would have told me that a video would be issued by these right-wing organizations that are all connected, I call them gongs, not really NGOs. These are governmental, non-governmental organizations. They are all connected to the Prime Minister's milieu, and they all have channels to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and to the Israeli Prime Minister's office, and they hold conferences together, and they influence the language. If you read about the recent Human Rights Watch fiasco, in which the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs actually cut and pasted language from NGO Monitor website saying that Human Rights Watch is a Palestinian propaganda and that it falsely raises the banner of human rights. Human Rights Watch, an organization that has won the Nobel Peace Prize together with others in the 90s. So you can see how these groups have become influential. So if anyone would have told me that one of them would issue a video that would call four of my friends aiders to terrorists and would go viral, and that Breaking the Silence and Yesh Din would need to start thinking that in their budget they have to add a line for bodyguards and for internet, what is it called? Cybersecurity, that's it. I mean, these are things, when I remember days, I'm not so old, but I remember days when I met foreign journalists. You know, I would criticize my government just like now. I would criticize my government constantly, but then there was always this pleasant moment when I would say, but I have complete freedom to say everything that I told you now, and I work in an environment that allows me to resist. And yes, I'm not a Palestinian. Palestinians are not in my position. And I know that when I say all this that I tell you now, it could be misunderstood as, you know, oh, big deal, Palestinians have been gone through much worse for many years. That's true. And still, it's a big, big change when Israel starts targeting its own citizens and makes resistance, makes dissent, nonviolent, legal dissent, working through Israeli law courts, something that is that bears a sanction, something that in order to be involved in, you do not only have to be a decent person, but also brave. And by the way, it works, because there are many more decent people than brave people in any society. And when I see what happens in the Israeli society and how academics and teachers and politicians politicians who I talk to and say one thing over the phone and another thing in the media, because they're afraid that they would also be stained as supporters of breaking the silence, for example. How they close ranks. And of course there is another counter process, because when things get so tight, people have to make a stand, and they have to tell, and they have to decide where they are. People who in the past could sit on the fence and not be political now have to decide. For example, high school principals who were told by the Ministry of Education not to allow breaking the silence people to lecture before senior students, students who in several months would join the, would be drafted to the army. And many of them have resisted and said, no, we will allow breaking the silence to talk to our students, as we allow groups that have something else to say to them. But we're facing with a wave, a tsunami of bills and legislations, all targeted at closing up the democratic space for us to work in. So we have the NGO bill that was passed last year, which basically obligates me as a representative of human rights organizations, beginning in January of 2018, in every letter that I send, in every meeting that I attend, and my clients in any publications that they make, basically say that we are a representatives of a foreign government. Now, it has nothing to do with merit. It has only to do with stigmatizing us as people who work not because what we do we believe is the best for our society, the best for our country, but because we represent some foreign interests. And that is a very Putinist strategy I mean, this is the exact type of methodology that brought the Russian civil society down. And now there is a new bill that states that these organizations would have to be taxed. Now, if you read that there is a bill that suggests that Israeli NGOs would be taxed, you have to understand that that means closing up the organizations, because no cent that is sourced in, let's say, the EU, who is a big donor for human rights all around the globe, can go to an organization that will split and give one euro cannot be, all that euro must go to the human rights objective. And if 1 cent goes to a treasury of a foreign country, that's foreign aid. That's not something that can be done. So tax meaning stopping all the flow of funding for human rights organizations. This is the environment we work in. But I will not end with this tone. And I have to say that I said that when I was younger, I was very optimistic and maybe naive, and many people charge me of being naive also today. And by saying naive, I think they mean the idiot. But I have to say the following. I think that what we see now, the reason that we are so that the future seems so bleak, putting aside what happens in this country for a moment, which is amazing by itself, but the reason we in Israel look at the future and do not see how anything materially changes is because we have, as human beings, this this tendency to think that a change, and definitely a massive change, is a process, and that if it is somewhere in the future, we would see signs to it. When we travel to a certain destination, we expect to see road signs saying you're 100 miles away, now you're 80 miles away, we're progressing, 60 miles away. And the same goes with ending the occupation. We think if the occupation is going to end in 5 years, we should see now something that would tell us that it's going to happen. It's a great change. Well, I don't think that it's necessarily so. I don't think that big changes, historical changes, necessarily happen in a linear way. I think many changes have come about as a surprise. Think of it. The Berlin Wall fell, and just a week or 2 weeks before, no one anticipated it. The apartheid in South Africa ended, and no one anticipated it a short while before that. The Arab Spring erupted, and no Arab expert could tell us the day before that it's going to happen. Both intifadas, uprisings, of the Palestinian uprisings, took the Israeli government by surprise with all its experts on Palestinian and Palestinian politics and Palestinian character and Palestinian psychology. They knew nothing of what's going on. And the reason for this is that although the land we walk on seems very, very stable, it looks straight, there are no cracks, nothing, it might just be that underneath the surface there are cracks. And since and that one day these cracks will come together, and like a sinkhole in the Dead Sea, it will open up. And the whole thing will collapse. Now, since I got to that conclusion, I became a human seismograph. I'm trying to see and locate these cracks. And let me tell you this. Think of a margin that would land in Israel-Palestine from Mars. And he would read the papers, and he would watch TV, and he would look around and walk in the streets, and go back to Mars after a month. And he would have to report to his fellow aliens. And he would say something like that. He would say, well, there is a government led by one Netanyahu, and it's very shaky because there is a mighty political power that is probably almost overthrowing that government. And that power is called B'Tselem and Breaking the Silence. And the government is doing everything it can to stop them from winning. And, you know, Breaking the Silence and B'Tselem in Israel are a niche. The number of supporters is small. I mean, they're very important and good people that support these groups. But in numbers, they're very small. So why does the government and all its allies invest so much in targeting these groups? What is the reason? And the reason is that they understand that these groups, by providing credible information to the Israelis and to the international community, by maintaining a dissenting voice from within, they impact the future of this conflict. And the government also feels that there is some kind of a ring that is getting tighter and tighter around it. You know, the two demons that chase Israelis at night are two, I would say, completely imaginative demons. There are two three-letter acronyms, ICC and BDS. If Israelis would know what I know about the ICC and the chance that an Israeli soldier would be indicted in the ICC, if Israelis would know what is the real impact, at least for the time being, on Israeli economy of the BDS, they would probably sleep better at night. But it's not about facts. It's about perception. And every supermarket in Washington State that decides to stop buying products from Israel is reported in top headlines in Israel. And every hiccup by the ICC prosecutor is being a major story in Israel. And this is because the ground is not stable. Because a massive abusing regime is never, ever stable and is not sustainable. And this is why the work that you're doing, the work that we're doing, is so important, because the occupation will end. Thank you.
That was Israeli human rights attorney Michael Sfard speaking at the NYU Law School. We want to thank Steve Lowe and Ed Briotti for production assistance, and of course, Stan Robinson for maintaining our permanent archive. We're out of time. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for joining us this morning, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.